The Messiah. "We all have that special dream when we are young," said Bishop Kelly. The others at the table murmured, nodded. "There is no Christian boy," the bishop continued, "who does not some night wonder, am I him? Is this the second coming at long last, and am I it? What, dear God, if I were Jesus? How grand!" The priests, the ministers, and the one lonely rabbi laughed gently, remembering things from their own childhoods, their own wild dreams, and being great fools. "I suppose," said the young priest, Father Niven, "that Jewish boys imagine themselves Moses?"
"No, no, my dear friend," said Rabbi Nittler. "The Messiah! The Messiah!"
More quiet laughter from all.
"Of course," said Father Niven out of his fresh pink and cream face. "How stupid of me. Christ wasn't the Messiah, was he? And your people are still waiting for him to arrive. Strange. All the ambiguities."
"And nothing more ambiguous than this."
Bishop Kelly rose to escort them all out onto a terrace, which had a view of the Martian hills, the ancient Martian towns, the old highways, the rivers of dust and earth, 60 million miles away, shining with a clear light in this alien sky.
"Did we ever, in our wildest dreams," said the Reverend Smith, "imagine that one day each of us would have a Baptist church, a St. Mary's chapel, a Mount Sinai synagogue here on Mars?"
The answer was no. No. Softly, from them all. Their quiet was interrupted by another voice which moved among them. Father Niven, as they stood at the balustrade, had tuned his transistor radio to check the hour. News was being broadcast from the small, new American Martian wilderness colony below. They listened.
"Rumored near the town. This is the first Martian reported in our community this year. Citizens are urged to respect any such visitor, if..."
Father Niven shut the news off.
"Our elusive congregation," sighed the Reverend Smith. "I must confess, I came to Mars not only to work with Christians, but hoping to invite one Martian to Sunday supper to learn of his theologies, his needs."
"We are still too new to them," said Father Lipscomb. "In another year or so, I think they will understand we're not buffalo hunters in search of pelts. Still, it is hard to keep one's curiosity in hand. After all, our mariner photographs indicated no life whatsoever here. Yet life there is, very mysterious and half resembling the human."
"Half, Your Eminence," the rabbi mused over his coffee. "I feel they are even more human than ourselves. They have let us come in. They have hidden in the hills, coming among us only on occasion, we guess, disguised as Earthmen."
"Do you really believe they have telepathic powers, then, and hypnotic abilities which allow them to walk in our towns, fooling us with masks and visions, and none of us the wiser?"
"I do so believe."
"Then this," said the bishop, handing around brandies and creme de menthe, "is a true evening of frustrations. Martians who will not reveal themselves so as to be saved by us, the enlightened." Many smiles at this. "And second comings of Christ delayed for several thousand years. How long must we wait, O Lord?"
"As for myself," said young Father Niven, "I never wished to be Christ, the second coming. I just always wanted with all my heart to meet him. Ever since I was 8, I have thought on that. It might well be the first reason I became a priest."
"To have the inside track, just in case he ever did arrive again?" suggested the rabbi kindly.
The young priest grinned and nodded. The others felt the urge to reach and touch him, for he had touched some vague, small, sweet nerve in each. They felt immensely gentle.
"With your permission, rabbi, gentlemen," said Bishop Kelly, raising his glass, "to the first coming of the Messiah, or the second coming of Christ. May they be more than some ancient, some foolish dreams." They drank and were quiet. The bishop blew his nose and wiped his eyes. The rest of the evening was like many another for the priests, the reverends, and the rabbi. They fell to playing cards and arguing St. Thomas Aquinas, but failed under the onslaught of Rabbi Nittler's educated logic. They named him Jesuit, drank nightcaps, and listened to the late radio news.
It is feared this Martian may feel trapped in our community. Anyone meeting him should turn away so as to let the Martian pass. Curiosity seems his motive. No cause for alarm. That concludes our...
While heading for the door, the priests, ministers, and rabbi discussed translations they had made into various tongues from Old and New Testaments. It was then that young Father Niven surprised them.
"Did you know I was once asked to write a screenplay on the Gospels? They needed an ending for their film."
"Surely," protested the bishop, "there's only one ending to Christ's life."
"But, Your Holiness, the four Gospels tell it with four variations. I compared. I grew excited. Why? Because I rediscovered something I had almost forgotten. The Last Supper isn't really the Last Supper."
"Dear me. What is it, then?"
"Why, Your Holiness, the first of several, sir. The first of several. After the crucifixion and burial of Christ, did not Simon called Peter, with the disciples, fish the Sea of Galilee?"
"They did."
"And their nets were filled with a miracle of fish?"
"They were."
"And seeing on the shore of Galilee a pale light, did they not land and approach what seemed a bed of white-hot coals on which fresh-caught fish were baking?"
"Yes. Ah, yes," said the Reverend Smith.
"And there, beyond the glow of the soft charcoal fire, did they not sense a spirit presence and call out to it?"
"They did."
"Getting no answer, did not Simon called Peter whisper again, 'Who is there?' And the unrecognized ghost upon the shore of Galilee put out its hand into the firelight, and in the palm of that hand, did they not see the mark where the nail had gone in, the stigmata that would never heal? They would have fled, but the ghost spoke and said, 'Take of these fish and feed thy brethren.' And Simon called Peter, took the fish that baked upon the white-hot coals and fed the disciples. And Christ's frail ghost then said, 'Take of my word and tell it among the nations of all the world, and preach therein forgiveness of sin.' And then Christ left them. And in my screenplay, I had him walk along the shore of Galilee toward the horizon. And when anyone walks toward the horizon, he seems to ascend. Yes? For all land rises at a distance. And he walked on along the shore until he was just a small mote far away, and then they could see him no more. And as the sun rose upon the ancient world, all his thousand footprints that lay along the shore blew away in the dawn winds and were as nothing. And the disciples left the ashes of that bed of coals to scatter in sparks, and with the taste of real and final and true Last Supper upon their mouths, went away. And in my screenplay, I had my camera drift high above to watch the disciples move some north, some south, some to the east, to tell the world what needed to be told about one man. And their footprints, circling in all directions, like the spokes of an immense wheel, blew away out of the sand in the winds of morn. And it was a new day. The end."
The young priest stood in the center of his friends, cheeks fired with color, eyes shut. Suddenly he opened his eyes, as if remembering where he was.
"Sorry."
"For what?"
cried the bishop, brushing his eyelids with the back of his hand, blinking rapidly.
"For making me weep twice in one night? What, self-conscious in the presence of your own love for Christ? Why, you have given the word back to me. Me, who has known the word for what seems a thousand years. You have freshened my soul. Oh, good young man with the heart of a boy. The eating of fish on Galilee's shore is the true Last Supper. Bravo! You deserve to meet him. The second coming, it's only fair, must be for you."
"I am unworthy," said Father Niven.
"So are we all, but if a trade of souls were possible, I'd loan mine out on this instant to borrow yours fresh from the laundry. Another toast, gentlemen? To Father Niven. And then, good night. It's late. Good night.
The toast was drunk, and all departed. The rabbi and the ministers down the hill to their holy places, leaving the priests to stand a last moment at their door, looking out at Mars, this strange world, and a cold wind blowing. Midnight came, and then one and two, and at three in the cold deep morning of Mars, Father Niven stirred. Candles flickered in soft whispers. Leaves fluttered against his window. Suddenly he sat up in bed, half startled by a dream of mob cries and pursuits. He listened. Far away, below, he heard the shutting of an outside door. Throwing on a robe, Father Niven went down the dim rectory stairs and through the church, where a dozen candles here or there kept their own pools of light. He made the rounds of all the doors, thinking, silly. Why lock churches? What is there to steal? But still he prowled the sleeping night, and found the front door of the church unlocked, and softly being pushed in by the wind. Shivering, he shut the door. Soft running footsteps. He spun about. The church lay empty. The candle flames leaned now this way, now that, in their shrines. There was only the ancient smell of wax and incense burning, stuffs left over from all the marketplaces of time and history, other suns and other noons. In the midst of glancing at the crucifix above the main altar, he froze. There was a sound of a single drop of water falling in the night. Slowly he turned to look at the baptistry in the back of the church. There were no candles there, yet. A pale light shone from that small recess where stood the baptismal font.
Bishop Kelly?
He called softly. Walking slowly up the aisle, he grew very cold and stopped because another drop of water had fallen, hit, dissolved away. It was like a faucet dripping somewhere, but there were no faucets, only the baptismal font itself, into which, drop by drop, a slow liquid was falling, with three heartbeats between each sound. At some secret level, Father Niven's heart told itself something and raced, then slowed and almost stopped. He broke into a wild perspiration. He found himself unable to move, but move he must, one foot after the other, until he reached the arched doorway of the baptistry. There was indeed a pale light within the darkness of the small place. No, not a light. A shape. A figure. The figure stood behind and beyond the baptismal font. The sound of falling water had stopped. His tongue locked in his mouth, his eyes flexed wide in a kind of madness, Father Niven felt himself struck blind. Then vision returned, and he dared cry out,
"Who?"
A single word, which echoed back from all around the church, which made candle flames flutter in reverberation, which stirred the dust of incense, which frightened his own heart with its swift return in saying, "Who?" The only light within the baptistry came from the pale garments of the figure that stood there facing him, and this light was enough to show him an incredible thing. As Father Niven watched, the figure moved. It put a pale hand out upon the baptistry air. The hand hung there as if not wanting to, a separate thing from the ghost beyond, as if it were seized and pulled forward, resisting by Father Niven's dreadful and fascinated stare to reveal what lay in the center of its open white palm. There was fixed a jagged hole, a cincture from which, slowly, one by one, blood was dripping, falling away down and slowly down into the baptismal font. The drops of blood struck the holy water, colored it, and dissolved in slow ripples. The hand remained for a stunned moment there before the priest's now blind, now seeing eyes. As if struck a terrible blow,
The priest collapsed to his knees with an outgasped cry, half of despair, half of revelation, one hand over his eyes, the other fending off the vision.
No, 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 no! It can't!
It was as if some dreadful physician of dentistry had come upon him without narcotic, and with one seizure entire extracted his soul, bloodied, raw, out of his body. He felt himself prized, his life yanked forth, and the roots, oh God, were deep.
No, 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 no.
But yes, between the lacings of his fingers he looked again, and the man was there, and the dreadful bleeding palm quivered dripping upon the baptistry air.
Enough!
The palm pulled back. Vanished. The ghost stood waiting. And the face of the spirit was good and familiar. Those strange, beautiful, deep, and incisive eyes were as he knew they always must be. There was the gentleness of the mouth, and the paleness framed by the flowing locks of hair and beard. The man was robed in the simplicity of garments worn upon the shores and in the wilderness near Galilee. The priest, by a great effort of will, prevented his tears from spilling over, stopped up his agony of surprise, doubt, shock, these clumsy things which rioted within and threatened to break forth. He trembled, and then saw that the figure, the spirit, the man, the ghost, whatever, was trembling too. No, thought the priest, he can't be. Afraid? Afraid of me? And now the spirit shook itself with an immense agony not unlike his own, like a mirror image of his own concussion, gaped wide its mouth, shut up its own eyes, and mourned,
"Oh, please, let me go."
At this, the young priest opened his eyes wider and gasped. He thought, "But you're free. No one keeps you here." And in that instant,
"Yes,"
cried the vision.
"You keep me. Please, avert your gaze. The more you look, the more I become this. I am not what I seem."
"But," thought the priest, "I did not speak. My lips did not move. How does this ghost know my mind?"
"I know all you think,"
said the vision. Trembling, pale, pulling back in baptistry gloom.
"Every sentence, every word. I did not mean to come. I ventured into town. Suddenly I was many things to many people. I ran. They followed. I escaped here. The door was open. I entered. And then was trapped."
"No," thought the priest.
"Yes,"
mourned the ghost.
"By you."
Slowly now, groaning under an even more terrible weight of revelation, the priest grasped the edge of the font and pulled himself, swaying, to his feet. At last he dared force the question out.
"You are not what you seem?"
"I am not," said the other.
"Forgive me. I," thought the priest, "shall go mad."
"Do not," said the ghost,
"or I shall go down to madness with you. I can't give you up, oh, dear God, now that you're here, after all these years, all my dreams. Don't you see? It's asking too much. 2,000 years, a whole race of people have waited for your return, and I am the one who meets you, sees you."
"You meet only your own dream. You see only your own need. Behind all this," the figure touched its own robes and breast,
"I am another thing." "What must I do?"
the priest burst out, looking now at the heavens, now at the ghost which shuddered at his cry.
"What?" "Avert your gaze. In that moment, I will be out the door and gone.
Just like that?
Please, said the man.
The priest drew a series of breaths, shivering.
Oh, if this moment could last for just an hour.
Would you kill me?
No!
If you keep me, force me into this shape some little while longer. My death will be on your hands.
The priest bit his knuckles and felt a convulsion of sorrow rack his bones.
You are a Martian, then?
No more, no less.
And I have done this to you with my thoughts?
You did not mean. When you came downstairs, your old dream seized and made me over. My palms still bleed from the wounds you gave out of your secret mind.
The priest shook his head, dazed.
Just a moment more. Wait.
He gazed steadily, hungrily, at the darkness where the ghost stood out of the light.
That face was beautiful. And oh, those hands were loving and beyond all description. The priest nodded, a sadness in him now as if he had within the hour come back from the true Calvary. And the hour was gone, and the coal strewn dying on the sand near Galilee.
If I let you go,
you must. Oh, you must.
If I let you go, will you promise?
What?
Will you promise to come back?
Come back,
cried the figure in the darkness.
Once a year, that's all I ask. Come back once a year, here to this place, this font, at the same time of night.
Come back?
Promise! Oh, I must know this moment again. You don't know how important it is. Promise, or I won't let you go.
I...
Say it, swear it.
I promise, said the pale ghost in the dark. I swear.
Thank you. Oh, thanks.
On what day a year from now must I return?
The tears had begun to roll down the young priest's face now. He could hardly remember what he wanted to say, and when he said it, he could hardly hear.
Easter. Oh, God, yes. Easter, a year from now.
Please, don't weep,
said the figure.
I will come. Easter, you say? I know your calendar. Yes. Now,
the pale, wounded hand moved in the air, softly pleading.
May I go?
The priest ground his teeth to keep the cries of woe from exploding forth.
Bless me and go.
Like this?
Said the voice. And the hand came out to touch him ever so quietly.
Quick!
Cried the priest, eyes shut, clenching his fists hard against his ribs to prevent his reaching out to seize.
Go before I keep you forever. Run! Run!
The pale hand touched him a last time upon his brow. There was a soft run of naked feet. A door opened upon stars. The door slammed. There was a long moment when the echo of the slam made its way through the church to every altar, into every alcove, and up like a blind flight of some single bird seeking and finding release in the apse. The church stopped trembling at last, and the priest laid his hands on himself as if to tell himself how to behave, how to breathe again, be still, be calm, stand tall. Finally, he stumbled to the door and held to it, wanting to throw it wide, look out at the road which must be empty now, with perhaps a figure in white, far fleeing. He did not open the door. He went about the church, glad for things to do, finishing out the ritual of locking up. It was a long way around to all the doors. It was a long way to next Easter. He paused at the font and saw the clear water with no trace of red. He dipped his hand and cooled his brow and temples and cheeks and eyelids. Then he went slowly up the aisle and laid himself out before the altar and let himself burst forth and really weep. He heard the sound of his sadness go up and come back in agonies from the tower where the bell hung silent. And he wept for many reasons. For himself. For the man who had been here a moment ago. For the long time until the rock was rolled back and the tomb found empty again. Until Simon called Peter once more saw the ghost upon the Martian shore, and himself Simon Peter. And most of all, he wept because never in his life could he speak of this night to anyone.
GBS Mark 5.
Charlie, where are you going?
Members of the rocket crew, passing, called. Charles Willis did not answer. He took the vacuum tube down through the friendly humming bowels of the spaceship. He fell, thinking, this is the grand hour.
Chuck, we're traveling,
someone called. To meet someone dead but alive, cold but warm, forever untouchable but reaching out somehow to touch.
Idiot! Fool!
The voice echoed. He smiled. Then he saw Clive, his best friend, drifting up in the opposite chute. He averted his gaze, but Clive sang out through his seashell earpack radio.
I want to see you!
Later, Willis said.
I know where you're going, stupid!
And Clive was gone up a way while Willis fell softly down, his hands trembling. His boots touched surface. On the instant he suffered renewed delight. He walked down through the hidden machineries of the rocket. Lord, he thought. Crazy. Here we are, 100 days gone away from the Earth in space, and this very hour, most of the crew, in fever, dialing their aphrodisiac animatronic devices that touched and hummed to them in their shut clamshell beds. While, what do I do? He thought. This. He moved to peer into a small storage pit. There, in an eternal dusk, sat the old man.
Sir,
he said, and waited.
Shaw,
he whispered.
Oh, Mr. George Bernard Shaw.
The old man's eyes sprang wide as if he had swallowed an idea. He seized his bony knees and gave a sharp cry of laughter.
By God, I do accept it all.
Accept what, Mr. Shaw?
Mr. Shaw flashed his bright blue gaze upon Charles Willis.
The universe. It thinks. Therefore, I am. So I had best accept, eh? Sit.
Willis sat in the shadowed areaway, clasping his knees and his own warm delight with being here again.
Shall I read your mind, young Willis, and tell you what you've been up to since last we conversed?
Can you read minds, Mr. Shaw?
No, thank God. Wouldn't it be awful if I were not only the cuneiform tablet robot of George Bernard Shaw, but could also scan your head bumps and spell your dreams? Unbearable.
You already are, Mr. Shaw.
Touché. Well, now.
The old man raked his reddish beard with his thin fingers, then poked Willis gently in the ribs.
How is it you are the only one aboard this starship who ever visits me?
Well, sir, you see...
The young man's cheeks burnt themselves to full blossom.
Ah, yes, I do see, said Shaw. Up through the honeycomb of the ship, all the happy male bees in their hives with their syrupy, wind-up, soft-singing, nimble, nibbling toys, their bright female puppets.
Mostly dumb.
Ah, well, it was not always thus. On my last trip, the captain wished to play Scrabble using only names of characters, concepts and ideas from my plays. Now, strange boy, why do you squat here in this hideous old ego? Have you no need for that soft and gentle company above stairs?
It's a long journey, Mr. Shaw. 2 years out beyond Pluto and back. Plenty of time for above-stairs company. Never enough for this. I have the dreams of a goat, but the genetics of a saint.
Well said!
The old man sprang lightly to his feet and paced about, pointing his beard now toward Alpha Centauri, now toward the nebula in Orion.
How runs our menu today, Willis? Shall I preface St. Joan for you, or...
Chuck?
Willis's head jerked. His seashell radio whispered in his ear.
Willis! Clive calling! You're late for dinner! I know where you are. I'm coming down, Chuck!
Willis thumped his ear. The voice cut off.
Quick, Mr. Shaw! Can you, well, run?
Can Icarus fall from the sun? Jump! I shall pace you with these spindly cricket legs.
They ran. Taking the corkscrew staircase instead of the air tube, they looked back from the top platform in time to see Clive's shadow dart into that tomb where Shaw had died, but to wake again.
Willis!
Cried his voice.
To hell with him, said Willis.
Shaw beamed. Hell, I know it well. Come, I'll show you around. Laughing, they jumped into the feather tube and fell up. This was the place of stars, which is to say, the one place in all the ship where, if one wished, one could come and truly look at the universe and the billion-billion stars which poured across it and never stopped pouring, cream from the mad dairies of the gods. Delicious frights or outcrops, on the other hand, if you thought it so, from the sickness of Lord God Jehovah, turned in his sleep, upset with creation, and birthing dinosaur worlds spun about satanic suns.
It's all in the thinking, observed Mr. Shaw, sidling his eyes at his young consort.
Mr. Shaw, you can read minds?
Poppycock, I merely read faces. Yours is clear glass. I glanced just now and saw Job afflicted, Moses in the burning bush. Come, let us look at the deeps and see what God has been up to in the 10 billion years since he collided with himself and procreated vastness.
They stood now, surveying the universe, counting the stars to 1 billion and beyond.
Oh,
moaned the young man suddenly, and tears fell from his eyes.
How I wish I had been alive when you were alive, sir. How I wish I had truly known you.
This, Shaw, is best, retorted the old man. All of the mincemeat and none of the tin. The coattails are better than the man. Hang to them and survive.
Space lay all about, as vast as God's first thought, as deep as his primal breathing. They stood, one of them tall, one short, by the scanning window, with a fine view of the great Andromeda Nebula whenever they wished to focus it near with a touch of the button which made the eye magnify and suck things close. After a long moment of drinking stars, the young man let out his breath.
Mr. Shaw, say it. You know what I like to hear.
Do I, my boy?
Mr. Shaw's eyes twinkled. All of space was around them, all the universe, all the night of the celestial being, all the stars and all the places between the stars, and the ship moving on its silent course, and the crew of the ship busy at work or games or touching their amorous toys. So these two were alone with their talk. These two stood viewing the mystery and saying what must be said.
Say it, Mr. Shaw.
Well, now.
Mr. Shaw fixed his eyes on a star some 20 light-years away.
What are we? He asked.
Why, we are the miracle of force and matter making itself over into imagination and will. Incredible. The life force experimenting with forms. You for one. Me for another. The universe has shouted itself alive. We are one of the shouts. Creation turns in its abyss. We have bothered it, dreaming ourselves to shapes. The void is filled with slumbers. 10 billion on a billion on a billion bombardments of light and material that know not themselves, that sleep, moving, and move, but finally to make an eye and waken on themselves. Among so much that is flight and ignorance, we are the blind force that gropes like Lazarus from a billion light-year tomb. We summon ourselves, we say, O Lazarus, life force, truly come ye forth. So the universe, a motion of deaths, fumbles to reach across time, to feel its own flesh and know it to be ours. We touch both ways and find each other miraculous because we are one.
Mr. Shaw turned to glance at his young friend.
There you have it. Satisfied?
Oh, yes, I...
The young man stopped. Behind them, in the viewing cabin door, stood Clive. Beyond him, they could hear music pulsing from the far cubicles where crewmen and their huge toys played at amorous games.
Well, said Clive, what goes on?
Here? Interjected Shaw, lightly. Why, only the confounding of two energies making do with puzzlements. This contraption, he touched his own breast, speaks from computerized elations. That genetic conglomeration, he nods at his young friend, responds with raw, beloved, and true emotions. The sum of us, pandemonium spread on biscuits and devoured at high tea.
Clive swiveled his gaze to Willis.
Damn, you're nuts. At dinner you should have heard the laughter. You and this old man and just talk, they said. Just talk, talk. Look, idiot, it's your stand watch in 10 minutes. Be there. God.
And the door was empty. Clive was gone. Silently, Willis and Mr. Shaw floated down the drop tube to the storage pit beneath the vast machineries. The old man sat once again on the floor.
Mr. Shaw?
Willis shook his head, snorting softly.
Hell, why is it you seem more alive to me than anyone I have ever known?
Why, my dear young friend, replied the old man gently, what you warm your hands at are ideas, eh? I am a walking monument of concepts, scrimshaws of thought, electric deliriums of philosophy and wonder. You love concepts. I am their receptacle. You love dreams in motion. I move. You love palaver and jabber. I am the consummate palaverer and jabberer. You and I, together, masticate Alpha Centauri and spit forth universal myths. We chew upon the tail of Holly's comet and worry the horsehead nebula until it cries a monstrous uncle and gives over to our creation. You love libraries. I am a library. Tickle my ribs and I vomit forth Melville's whale, spirit spout and all. Tick my ear, and I'll build Plato's Republic with my tongue for you to run and live in. You love toys. I am a toy. A fabulous plaything. A computerized...
Friend, said Willis quietly.
Mr. Shaw gave him a look less of fire than of hearth.
Friend, he said.
Willis turned to leave, then stopped to gaze back at that strange old figure propped against the dark storage wall.
I'm afraid to go. I have this fear something may happen to you.
I shall survive, replied Shaw tartly, but only if you warn your captain that a vast meteor shower approaches. He must shift course a few 100,000 miles. Done?
Done.
But still Willis did not leave.
Mr. Shaw,
he said at last,
What do you do while the rest of us sleep?
Do? Why, bless you, I listen to my tuning fork. Then I write symphonies between my ears.
Willis was gone. In the dark, alone, the old man bent his head. A soft hive of dark bees began to hum under his honey-sweet breath.
4 hours later, Willis, off watch, crept into his sleep cubicle. In half-light, the mouth was waiting for him. Clive's mouth. It licked its lips and whispered,
"Everyone's talking about you making an ass out of yourself visiting a 200-year-old intellectual relic. You... Jesus! The psychomet'll be out tomorrow to x-ray your stupid skull!"
"Better that than what you men do all night, every night," said Willis.
"What we do is us."
"Then why not let me be me?"
"Because it's unnatural."
The tongue licked and darted.
"We all miss you. Tonight we piled all the grand toys in the midst of the wild room and..."
"I don't want to hear it."
"Well then," said the mouth, "I might just trot down and tell all this to your old gentleman friend."
"Don't go near him."
"I might."
The lips moved in the shadows.
"You can't stand guard on him forever. Some night soon, when you're asleep, someone might tamper with him, eh? Scramble his electronic eggs so he'll talk vaudeville instead of St. Joan?" "Huh. Yes. Think. Long journey. Crew's bored. Practical joke like that, worth a million to see you froth. Beware, Charlie. Best come play with us."
Willis, eyes shut, let the blaze out of him.
"Whoever dares to touch Mr. Shaw, so help me God, I'll kill!"
He turned violently on his side, gnawing the back of his fist. In the half-dark, he could sense Clive's mouth still moving.
"Kill? Well, well. Pity. Sweet dreams."
An hour later, Willis gulped 2 pills and fell stunned into sleep. In the middle of the night, he dreamed that they were burning good St. Joan at the stake, and, in the midst of burning, the plain potato maiden turned to an old man stoically wrapped around with ropes and vines. The old man's beard was fiery red even before the flames reached it, and his bright blue eyes were fixed fiercely upon eternity, ignoring the fire.
"Recant," cried a voice. "Confess and recant. Recant."
"There is nothing to confess, therefore no need for recantation," said the old man quietly. The flames leaped up his body like a mob of insane and burning mice.
"Mr. Shaw!"
screamed Willis. He sprang awake.
"Mr. Shaw!"
The cabin was silent. Clive lay asleep. On his face was a smile. The smile made Willis pull back with a cry. He dressed. He ran. Like a leaf in autumn, he fell down the air tube, growing older and heavier with each long instant. The storage pit where the old man slept was much more quiet than it had a right to be. Willis bent. His hand trembled. At last, he touched the old man.
"Sir?"
There was no motion. The beard did not bristle, nor the eyes fire themselves to blue flames, nor the mouth tremble with gentle blasphemies.
"Oh, Mr. Shaw,"
he said.
"Are you dead, then? Oh, God, are you really dead?"
The old man was what they called dead when a machine no longer spoke or tuned an electric thought or moved. His dreams and philosophies were snow in his shut mouth. Willis turned the body this way and that, looking for some cut, wound, or bruise on the skin. He thought of the years ahead, the long traveling years, and no Mr. Shaw to walk with, gibber with, laugh with. Women in the storage shelves, yes. Women in the cots late at night, laughing their strange taped laughters and moving their strange machined motions and saying the same dumb things that were said on 1,000 worlds on 1,000 nights.
"Oh, Mr. Shaw,"
he murmured at last,
"who did this to you?"
"Silly boy," whispered Mr. Shaw's memory voice.
"You know." "I know,"
thought Willis. He whispered a name and ran away.
"Damn you, you killed him!"
Willis seized Clive's bedclothes, at which instant Clive, like a robot, popped wide his eyes. The smile remained constant.
"You can't kill what was never alive," he said.
"Son of a bitch!"
He struck Clive once in the mouth, after which Clive was on his feet, laughing in some strange, wild way, wiping blood from his lips.
"What did you do to him?"
cried Willis.
"Not much, just..."
But that was the end of their conversation.
"On posts!"
a voice cried.
"Collision course!"
Bells rang. Sirens shrieked. In the midst of their shared rage, Willis and Clive turned cursing to seize emergency space suits and helmets off the cabin walls.
"Damn, oh damn, oh da-"
Half through his last damn, Clive gasped. He vanished out a sudden hole in the side of the rocket. The meteor had come and gone in a billionth of a second. On its way out, it had taken all the air in the ship with it through a hole the size of a small car. "My God," thought Willis. "He's gone forever." What saved Willis was a ladder he stood near, against which the swift river of air crushed him on its way into space. For a moment he could not move or breathe. Then the suction was finished, all the air in the ship gone. There was only time to adjust the pressure in his suit and helmet and glance wildly around at the veering ship, which was being bombarded now as in a space war. Men ran, or rather floated, shouting wildly, everywhere. "Shaw," thought Willis unreasonably, and had to laugh. "Shaw." A final meteor and a tribe of meteors struck the motor section of the rocket and blew the entire ship apart. "Shaw, Shaw, oh Shaw," thought Willis. He saw the rocket fly apart like a shredded balloon, all its gases only impelling it to more disintegration. With the bits and pieces went wild crowds of men, dismissed from school, from life, from all and everything, never to meet face to face again, not even to say farewell. The dismissal was so abrupt, and their deaths and isolation such a swift surprise. "Goodbye," thought Willis. But there was no true goodbye. He could hear no weeping and no laments over his radio. Of all the crew, he was the last and final and only one alive because of his suit, his helmet, his oxygen, miraculously spared. For what? To be alone and fall? To be alone. To fall. "Oh, Mr. Shaw. Oh, sir," he thought. "No sooner called than delivered," whispered a voice. It was impossible, but drifting, spinning, the ancient doll with the wild red beard and blazing blue eyes fell across darkness as if impelled by God's breath on a whim. Instinctively, Willis opened his arms, and the old party landed there, smiling, breathing heavily or pretending to breathe heavily, as was his bent. "Well, well, Willis, quite a treat, eh?"
"Mr. Shaw, you were dead."
"Poppycock! Someone bent some wires in me. The collision knocked things back together. The disconnection is here below my chin. A villain cut me there. So if I fall dead again, jiggle under my jaw and wire me up, eh?"
"Yes, sir."
"How much food do you carry at this moment, Willis?"
"Enough to last 200 days in space."
"Dear me, that's fine, fine. And self-recycling oxygen units also for 200 days?
"Yes, sir. Now, how long will your batteries last, Mr. Shaw?"
10,000 years, the old man sang out happily. "Yes, I vow, I swear. I am fitted with solar cells which will collect God's universal light until I wear out my circuits."
"Which means you will outtalk me, Mr. Shaw, long after I have stopped eating and breathing."
"At which point you must dine on conversation and breathe past particles instead of air. But we must hold the thought of rescue uppermost. Are not the chances good?"
"Rockets do come by, and I am equipped with radio signals,
which even now cry out into the deep night.
I'm here with Ramshackle Shaw, eh?
I'm here with Ramshackle Shaw, thought Willis, and was suddenly warm in winter.
Well then, while we're waiting to be rescued, Charles Willis, what next?
Next? Why... They fell away down space, alone but not alone, fearful but elated, and now grown suddenly quiet.
Say it, Mr. Shaw.
Say what?
You know. Say it again.
Well, then.
They spun lazily, holding to each other.
Isn't life miraculous? Matter and force, yes. Matter and force, making itself over into intelligence and will.
Is that what we are, sir?
We are. Bet 10,000 bright tin whistles on it, we are. Shall I say more, young Willis?
Please, sir,
laughed Willis.
I want some more.
And the old man spoke, and the young man listened. And the young man spoke, and the old man hooted, and they fell around a corner of universe away out of sight, eating and talking, talking and eating, the young man biting gumball foods, the old man devouring sunlight with his solar cell eyes, and the last that was seen of them, they were gesticulating and babbling and conversing and waving their hands until their voices faded into time, and the solar system turned over in its sleep, and covered them with a blanket of dark and light. And whether or not a rescue ship named Rachel, seeking her lost children, ever came by and found them, who can tell? Who would truly ever want to know? The Utterly Perfect Murder. It was such an utterly perfect, such an incredibly delightful idea for murder that I was half out of my mind all across America. The idea had come to me for some reason on my 48th birthday. Why it hadn't come to me when I was 30 or 40, I cannot say. Perhaps those were good years, and I sailed through them unaware of time and clocks and the gathering of frost at my temples or the look of the lion about my eyes. Anyway, on my 48th birthday, lying in bed that night beside my wife, with my children sleeping through all the other quiet moonlit rooms of my house, I thought, I will arise and go now and kill Ralph Underhill. Ralph Underhill, I cried. Who in God's name is he? 36 years later, kill him? For what? Why, I thought, for what he did to me when I was 12. My wife woke an hour later, hearing a noise.
Doug, she called. What are you doing?
Packing, I said. For a journey.
Oh,
she murmured, and rolled over and went to sleep.
Board! All aboard!
The porter's cries went down the train platform. The train shuddered and banged.
See you!
I cried, leaping up the steps.
Someday,
called my wife.
I wish you'd fly.
Fly, I thought, and spoil thinking about murder all across the plains? Spoil oiling the pistol and loading it and thinking of Ralph Underhill's face when I show up 36 years late to settle old scores? Fly? Why, I would rather pack cross-country on foot, pausing by night to build fires and fry my bile and sour spit and eat again my old mummified but still living antagonisms and touch those bruises which have never healed. Fly? The train moved. My wife was gone. I rode off into the past. Crossing Kansas the second night, we hit a beaut of a thunderstorm. I stayed up until 4 in the morning, listening to the rave of winds and thunders. At the height of the storm, I saw my face, a dark room negative print on the cold window glass, and thought, where is that fool going? To kill Ralph Underhill. Why? Because... Remember how he hit my arm? Bruises. I was covered with bruises, both arms, dark blue, mottled black, strange yellow bruises. Hit and run. That was Ralph. Hit and run. And yet, you loved him? Yes,
As boys love boys when boys are 8, 10, 12, and the world is innocent, and boys are evil beyond evil, because they know not what they do, but do it anyway. So, on some secret level, I had to be hurt. We dear fine friends needed each other. I to be hit, he to strike. My scars were the emblem and the symbol of our love. What else makes you want to murder Ralph so late in time? The train whistle shrieked. Night country rolled by. And I recalled one spring when I came to school in a new tweed knicker suit and Ralph knocking me down, rolling me in snow and fresh brown mud. And Ralph laughing and me going home, shamefaced, covered with slime, afraid of a beating, to put on fresh dry clothes. Yes. And what else? Remember those toy clay statues you longed to collect from the Tarzan radio show? Statues of Tarzan and Kala the ape and Numa the lion for just 25 cents? Yes, yes, beautiful, even now in memory. Oh, the sound of the ape-man swinging through green jungles far away, ululating. But who had 25 cents in the middle of the Great Depression? No one. Except Ralph Underhill. And one day Ralph asked you if you wanted one of the statues. Wanted, you cried. Yes, yes. That was the same week your brother, in a strange seizure of love mixed with contempt, gave you his old but expensive baseball catcher's mitt. Well, said Ralph, I'll give you my extra Tarzan statue if you'll give me that catcher's mitt. Fool, I thought. The statue's worth 25 cents. The glove cost $2. No fair. Don't. But I raced back to Ralph's house with the glove and gave it to him, and he, smiling a worse contempt than my brother's, handed me the Tarzan statue, and, bursting with joy, I ran home. My brother didn't find out about his catcher's mitt and the statue for 2 weeks. And when he did, he ditched me when we hiked out in farm country and left me lost because I was such a sap.
Tarzan statues! Baseball mitts! He cried. That's the last thing I ever give you!
And somewhere on a country road I just lay down and wept and wanted to die, but didn't know how to give up the final vomit that was my miserable ghost. The thunder murmured. The rain fell on the cold Pullman car windows. What else? Is that the list? No. One final thing, more terrible than all the rest. In all the years you went to Ralph's house to toss up small bits of gravel on his 4th of July, 6 in the morning, fresh dewy window, or to call him forth for the arrival of dawn circuses in the cold, fresh blue railroad stations in late June or late August, in all those years never once did Ralph run to your house. Never once in all the years did he, or anyone else, prove their friendship by coming by. The door never knocked. The window of your bedroom never faintly clattered and belled with a high-tossed confetti of small dusts and rocks. And you always knew that the day you stopped going to Ralph's house, calling up in the morn, that would be the day your friendship ended. You tested it once. You stayed away for a whole week. Ralph never called. It was as if you had died, and no one came to your funeral. When you saw Ralph at school, there was no surprise, no query, not even the faintest lint of curiosity to be picked off your coat. Where were you, Doug? I need someone to beat. Where you been, Doug? I got no one to pinch. Add all the sins up, but especially think on the last. He never came to my house. He never sang up to my early morning bed or tossed a wedding rice of gravel on the clear panes to call me down to joy and summer days. And for this last thing, Ralph Underhill, I thought, sitting in the train at 4 in the morning as the storm faded and I found tears in my eyes, for this last and final thing, for that I shall kill you tomorrow night. Murder, I thought, after 36 years. By God, you're madder than Ahab. The train wailed. We ran cross-country like a mechanical Greek fate carried by a black metal Roman fury. They say you can't go home again. That is a lie. If you are lucky and time is right, you arrive at sunset when the old town is filled with yellow light. I got off the train and walked up through Greentown and looked at the courthouse, burning with sunset light. Every tree was hung with gold doubloons of color. Every roof and coping and bit of gingerbread was purest brass and ancient gold. I sat in the courthouse square with dogs and old men until the sun had set and Greentown was dark. I wanted to savor Ralph Underhill's death. No one in history had ever done a crime like this. I would stay, kill, depart, a stranger among strangers. How would anyone dare say, finding Ralph Underhill's body on his doorstep, that a boy aged 12 arriving on a time machine train traveled out of hideous self-contempt and gunned down the past? It was beyond all reason. I was safe in my pure insanity. Finally, at 8:30 on this cool October night, I walked across town, past the ravine. I never doubted Ralph would still be there. People do, after all, move away. I turned down Park Street and walked 200 yards to a single street lamp and looked across. Ralph Underhill's white two-story Victorian house waited for me, and I could feel him in it. He was there, 48 years old, even as I felt myself here, 48, and full of an old and tired and self-devouring spirit. I stepped out of the light, opened my suitcase, put the pistol in my right-hand coat pocket, shut the case, and hid it in the bushes where, later, I would grab it and walk down into the ravine and across town to the train. I walked across the street and stood before his house, and it was the same house I had stood before 36 years ago. There were the windows upon which I had hurled those spring bouquets of rocks in love and total giving. There were the sidewalks spotted with firecracker burn marks from ancient July 4ths when Ralph and I had just blown up the whole damned world, shrieking celebrations. I walked up on the porch and saw on the mailbox in small letters, Underhill. What if his wife answers? No, I thought. He himself, with absolute Greek tragic perfection, will open the door and take the wound and almost gladly die for old crimes and minor sins somehow grown to crimes. I rang the bell. Will he know me, I wondered, after all this time? In the instant before the first shot, tell him your name. He must know who it is. Silence. I rang the bell again. The doorknob rattled. I touched the pistol in my pocket, my heart hammering, but did not take it out. The door opened. Ralph Underhill stood there. He blinked, gazing out at me. Ralph, I said.
Yes,
he said. We stood there, riven, for what could not have been more than 5 seconds. But, oh Christ, many things happened in those 5 swift seconds. I saw Ralph Underhill. I saw him clearly, and I had not seen him since I was 12. Then he had towered over me to pummel and beat and scream. Now he was a little old man. I am 5'11", but Ralph Underhill had not grown much from his 12th year on. The man who stood before me was no more than 5'2" tall. I towered over him. I gasped. I stared. I saw more. I was 48 years old. But Ralph Underhill, 48, had lost most of his hair, and what remained was threadbare gray, black and white. He looked 60 or 65. I was in good health. Ralph Underhill was waxen pale. There was a knowledge of sickness in his face. He had traveled in some sunless land. He had a ravaged and sunken look. His breath smelled of funeral flowers. All this, perceived, was like the storm of the night before, gathering all its lightnings and thunders into one bright concussion. We stood in the explosion.
So this is what I came for, I thought. This, then, is the truth. This dreadful instant in time. Not to pull out the weapon. Not to kill. No, no. But simply to see Ralph Underhill as he is in this hour. That's all. Just to be here, stand here, and look at him as he has become. Ralph Underhill lifted one hand in a kind of gesturing wonder. His lips trembled. His eyes flew up and down my body. His mind measured this giant who shadowed his door. At last his voice, so small, so frail, blurted out, "Doug?" I recoiled.
"Doug?"
he gasped.
"Is that you?"
I hadn't expected that. People don't remember. They can't. Across the years? Why would he know, bother, summon up, recognize, call? I had a wild thought that what had happened to Ralph Underhill was that after I left town, half of his life had collapsed. I had been the center of his world, someone to attack, beat, pummel, bruise. His whole life had cracked by my simple act of walking away 36 years ago. Nonsense. Yet, some small crazed mouse of wisdom scuttered about my brain and screeched what it knew. You needed Ralph, but more, he needed you. And you did the only unforgivable, the wounding thing. You vanished.
Doug?
He said again, for I was silent there on the porch with my hands at my sides.
Is that you?
This was the moment I had come for. At some secret blood level, I had always known I would not use the weapon. I had brought it with me, yes, but time had gotten here before me, and age, and smaller, more terrible deaths. Bang. 6 shots through the heart. But I didn't use the pistol. I only whispered the sound of the shots with my mouth. With each whisper, Ralph Underhill's face aged another 10 years. By the time I reached the last shot, he was 110 years old. Bang, I whispered. Bang, 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 bang. His body shook with the impact. You're dead.
Oh, God, Ralph.
You're dead. I turned and walked down the steps and reached the street before he called.
Doug! Is that you?
I did not answer, walking.
Answer me!
He cried, weakly.
Doug! Doug Spaulding! Is that you? Who is that? Who are you?
I got my suitcase and walked down into the cricket night and the darkness of the ravine and across the bridge and up the stairs, going away.
Who is that?
I heard his voice wail a last time. A long way off, I looked back. All the lights were on all over Ralph Underhill's house. It was as if he had gone around and put them all on after I left. On the other side of the ravine, I stopped on the lawn in front of the house where I had been born. Then I picked up a few bits of gravel and did the thing that had never been done, ever in my life. I tossed the few bits of gravel up to tap that window where I had lain every morning of my first 12 years. I called my own name. I called me down in friendship to play in some long summer that no longer was. I stood waiting just long enough for my other young self to come down to join me. Then swiftly, fleeing ahead of the dawn, we ran out of Green Town and back, thank you, dear Christ, back toward now and today for the rest of my life.